Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound. And you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello, and welcome to the Phantom Zone podcast, your one-stop shop for all things nerdy. If you like what you hear today and you want to hear more, you can find us on all podcasting platforms by searching the Phantom Zone, where you'll find our library of episodes like our comic book reading club, nerd news, great debates, and much more. Today, we are brought to you by the amazing UK Film Review. UK Film Review has created an outstanding network of podcasts, which we are excited to be part of. You can find these shows alongside ours, like Gay Actually and The Screen Test, on all those podcasting platforms mentioned before. But today, you are joining us as we journey to the mystical sands of Arrakis to discuss the long-awaited sequel to Denis Villeneuve's 2021 Dune Part 2. To help us listeners on this journey, I'm joined by our worm-riding Fremen, Toby.
Hello there. I'm riding on a worm right now.
And our very own Bene Gesserit, Simone.
Hi!
The noise of the Bene Gesserit whenever they arrive.
That's the voice. That's the voice.
How are you guys doing?
Yeah, I'm good. Thank you.
Riding that worm, man.
What?
I'm riding that worm.
Well, I literally am riding that worm because I will apologize now. I have a bad cold, or I'm getting over a cold. So if I cough or I sound my nose blocked at all, it's because of that. But I have been drinking cough medicine pretty much non-stop.
Don't waste water. Do not waste water. It is the water of life.
It's the water of life. I've drank that water, man. I've drank that water, and that water is cough medicine for me. So
that's sacred water.
That sacred water is 7% alcohol. That's what it is.
It's real good. It's real good. On the first day I had it, I was like, oh, what the hell is this? And then as we've been going on, I'm like, where's that cough medicine?
Give me some more medicine.
So yeah, no, we are here to talk about Dune Part 2. Which I'm very excited to do. Unfortunately, we're not with Chris today. He is riding them worms in the sands. He's gone on a trip.
On the dusty plains.
On the dusty plains. But I'll do a quick overview of the plot. We won't get into too much of the spoilers as we'll go through. But the film picks up pretty much exactly at the end of the previous one, where Paul has found himself hitched up with the Fremen in the desert, running away from the Harkonnens, who have just destroyed his home and his family, seeking a new way of life. But questions are up in the air on whether he is their chosen one or messiah. And Paul and his mother Jessica go on an adventure of a lifetime as they go through the desert, where his mother drinks, as you mentioned, the water of life, becomes the High Reverend Mother whilst being pregnant, which changes the biology of her daughter to be I guess, alive with all the consciousness. We'll get into that. And at the same time, the Harkonnens are having difficulties keeping control of the planet that they've now taken back from the Atreides household. They're trying to sell their spice. It's not going great. Paul is leading rebellions throughout the planet now, leading the Fremen against the Harkonnens to get revenge for his family, and all chaos ensues. I think that's a good overview. Anything to add?
Yeah.
No.
No, that was great.
Good summation.
Yeah, so...
gotta love me some chaos.
Chaos ensues. It's why I don't want to get too... Sometimes we do a bigger overview, but I think what we'll do is get into some spoiler talk a little bit later on, because I would say if you haven't seen this film, you definitely should. Like, it's a film to go see in the cinema. This review is coming out very early, but it should still be in cinema, so go see it in IMAX. It's outstanding, because that's what we saw it on, and it was great. So let's jump into our thoughts. Toby, starting with you, what were your thoughts on Dune? Just a general initial thoughts on it.
I mean, you're right about the IMAX of it all. It is definitely a spectacle piece. Denis Villeneuve, he's an auteur when it comes to visual spectacle. Mm. I mean, the work that he put into this, you can definitely feel the way I've sort of visualized this in my head is that part one was him laying the table, and then part two is sitting down to eat. You know, he's put all the groundwork down, but then he's
tasty dessert.
I don't know. Maybe. I hope so. I'm hoping so. Because part one was fantastic, but my criticism of that was it felt very much like a part one, and it kind of had an abrupt ending. Mm. This one, it felt more like a full film. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you felt like he was more comfortable in the world that he was like he'd created. He'd had more of an understanding of where he wanted the movie and the stories and the characters to sort of move throughout the film. And just, he had just a great concept of the scope that he wanted to portray. Mm-hmm. And I think scope and spectacle is just all the things that you can say about this film, because every set piece, every moving piece of this was just breathtaking. And in a sort of period of time where films have looked less and less visually appealing, mm-hmm, as time goes on, this is like, no, this is what cinema's about.
Yeah.
You know, you put someone with a bit of creativity, bit of artistry behind the camera, sometimes you're rewarded, especially if the producers and, let's say, Warner Brothers give them the opportunity to actually show off their expertise.
Yeah.
Because I thought it was great.
I completely agree with that. I think it's interesting you mention about the visual elements of it being outstanding for films nowadays. Simone and I literally yesterday were having a conversation about what films we have found visually stunning, because a colleague of yours, don't want to call them out, they seem very nice, was saying that the most visually, they might be nice, but this was a bad opinion, a visually stunning film that they had seen recently was Avatar: Way of the Water, which I was like, it does look fine, but like, it looks like the CGI is good, that's what I would say, but it doesn't do anything that I feel pushes boundaries in cinema.
Yeah,
whereas this, I felt, you are right, it, there are bits that are like, wow.
Avatar 2 to me always
good thing Chris is not here, otherwise we would be,
yeah. the trauma's undone. Yeah. I just felt Avatar 2 was a technical piece, like, yes, it was an amazing technical, like the first one, it was a technical display of expertise, like James Cameron and the team that he has working with him on those films, they can create technical marvels. Problem is, it's the storytelling and the characters that you got to deal with in that. Mm-hmm. Because, the underwater scenes, some of the technical shots that he got going were great. It was just in a bad film.
and if you want to hear more of that, go to our review of Avatar, where Chris has an aneurysm.
Yeah, let's not dig up that rock.
So, Simone, what were your initial thoughts, I guess, of the film as well?
I mean, it's a masterclass. It's a masterclass in directing. It's a masterclass in set design. Masterclass in acting. I absolutely loved watching this film. I didn't want it to finish. I was like, I need more. I want more. Talk about a runtime being an asset to this film.
Yeah, big time. Yeah.
Needs, there's so much that happens. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure we'll get onto this later with them packing in a lot of plot into this film. There was just this urgency to the film that just like kept ramping up. And I said this to Ian when we left the cinema. I was like, I feel like I've been on a roller coaster. Like,
you
I feel
like I've gone to Thorpe Park.
I feel like I've gone to Thorpe Park and gone on stealth. Like, that was phenomenal.
Although the lady next to you, it was quite funny. There was a particular shot, which again, okay, spoiler alert, when the worms come out of the dust, in the three or four worms at the dust, which, I mean, seen the trailer. You've seen the trailer. That is, she literally, it was quite amusing. She was like, oh, I'm a gust. Yeah, no.
She was like, three popcorn buckets, please.
This man is over a gasp. We kept referencing that afterwards. I was like, I am a gasp. I am a gasp. Because I like both of you. I think definitely I left. There's very few films that I leave a cinema or watch that make me go, like, I feel like I've had an experience watching this. And I left this film like genuinely like this was an experience. It kind of was the way I felt when I saw Blade Runner for the first time. Not when it originally came out, I'm not that old, but when it was re-released in cinemas, which I was very lucky to be. That was the first time I'd watched Blade Runner, was in York cinema. And it blew me away. I left and was like, oh my God, I feel like I've had a experience watching this. And that's how I felt with this too. And so when we are talking about those like bits that we've really enjoyed, we found it excited watching it. What were our highs for this film? I think we'll get into spoilers now because like we've liked it. Stop listening. You're 12 minutes in. Stop listening to the podcast. Go watch the film. Come back. Into spoilers, Simone. What were your like highs of this film?
Being on the Harkonnen planet.
Yeah.
That was insane.
Yeah.
It was so unsettling. Like the battle with Fade when he's up against the
Atreides.
The remainders of the Atreides household, I was like, I had visceral reaction to it. Everything about it was just so unsettling, and the it all kind of being in black and white, and the fact that their fireworks look like almost like blood splatters, like
spots and things.
Yeah,
you were having that was a definitely visceral. I can attest to that because you were like going. I could see on your face going.
I thought it was fantastic. It's so good.
I can't think of anything like that. Like, what would you compare that to? Like an ink blotted firework, negative world where everybody's got. Is that the fashion, by the way, on planet Harkonnen?
Yeah. Well, was it Gady Prime?
Yeah, Gady Prime. That's it. On Gady Prime, does everybody just shave their eyebrows and head? Is that the?
I think I read a thought process behind the stylistic, because like the Harkonnens in the book, they're supposed to be sort of like red hair, aren't
they? Yes, they are. Yeah,
like the Baron's supposed to be like ginger hair and representing the gingers.
he's
soulless beast.
Interestingly, and, they're meant to be like, not to diverge too much into book stuff because we'll get there a bit, but they're meant to be like ancestors of certain areas of the world. And the Harkonnens are meant to be Finnish. So they're meant to be more Norse Viking-esque.
Yeah, Frank Herbert. Yeah. I think what I read that David Villeneuve was sort of saying with regards to the Harkonnen style was that it was the idea that they were ridding themselves of anything sort of that could be conceived as imperfect. So they were sort of supposed to be sort of like clean and serene.
Hence,
you know, like these constant oil baths.
Yes, yeah. He loves the oil baths.
Make me greasy. I just think of that Willy scene from The Simpsons. Grease me up, woman!
Grease me up, woman!
Okie dokie.
Okie dokie. That's every time the Baron enters a room.
Yeah.
Grease me up. What were you going to say, sorry?
I just assumed it was like, because they live under a dying star,
I didn't think
that they're all just like super deficient in vitamin D, and like that, all of their hair's falling out.
You said this after they're all troglodytes.
I was like, they've got no, their son's like dying. None of them have vitamin D. Look how pale they are.
It's well, as a bald pale man, I kind of I was like, you Harkonnens, that's a style. That's a
and then it all went a bit awry, and you were like, ooh, like, ooh, no.
Okay.
No.
It's... Maybe I should bathe in oil.
Piss me up. you know, it is what I think it's actually probably my high as well is that scene. Yeah. I think the film in its totality is just a general high, but like that scene is like really at the top of my things that I loved. And
the Colosseum fight, you say as well.
Yeah, and I like that. So there's been several attempts to try and make a Dune film. And a long time people thought it was almost like unfilmable. And one of the first incantations of it was from a guy called Horobowski. I'm butchering his name, I'm sure, but a Chilean director who directed one of my favorite films, The Holy Mountain, which is one of my more pretentious, I guess, likes of films. It is very obscure and really weird.
Snob!
But it's a great film, and Horobowski is like a really trippy director, and his vision for Dune was to get like Salvador Dali doing like art for it. And he had H.A. Geiger doing all of the designs for the Harkonnen planet.
So did Lynch, didn't he?
He did, Lynch kind of picked that up too. And I feel Villeneuve has 100% been influenced by that for their planet. All of the black, huge domes and like the weird phallic-y sort of like armors. And it's all very, very strange and kind of what Geiger, and it's just really, as you say with the clean thing, Toby, like they are all weirdly, the entire planet is almost pristine, like their halls, but it's all
it's very
like,
stark, isn't it, of like the extremes. Super latexy sort of chromatic colors, and then just very straight angular some architecture. And
I did think
everything's to the extremes
with the guy who came in to give him the knives with his little BDSM outfit. I was like, oh, okay.
Well, that whole section was very BDSM-y to a degree.
Yeah,
it felt very much like, and here are your tools, sir, for the evening. And even the very sort of sexual way he was using the knives, you know, playing with it on his tongue and things. It was all very, you know, overtly sexual in undertones. And I think there was... I think the book sort of intimates that the Baron himself has got sort of some more questionable proclivities.
I don't think it suggests or intimates it pretty much solidly, because one of the it hints upon him and Fade, the Baron and Fade not quite getting on. One of the ways Fade tries to kill the Baron in the book is to poison a young prostitute that the Baron is using, shall we say. And and it's a really weird scene, which I'm really glad that they got rid of, because it's really it's not great. But I mean, we all love the planet. Toby, is there other things? I mean, you can keep going on about that planet, because there is a lot to talk about. There is a lot.
I mean, the planet was a visual highlight, definitely, because it was so stark in contrast to the rest of the film. I think for me, really, one of the biggest highlights was how convincing they made the story run throughout. You know, and it's difficult to articulate properly the way I'm trying to think of it, but I think it was being able to genuinely make Paul's story and his fall into, let's really face it, villainy towards the end of the movie, really quite convincing, because you could see it was a conflict throughout. And then, you know, there was this turning point where Fade attacks the settlement and the Holy Land of the Fremen. And that's sort of the turning point, but it's also where he's been completely manipulated by his mother. And
all the extremes come out. But I think they just executed that really well. But I think the other thing as well was I felt that it was, this film felt less of a characters reacting to what's happening in the film. It was more the film, the characters themselves were channeling the story, if you see what I mean, in the sense that Paul's journey throughout this film, it was his intentions to learn the way of the Fremen and take vengeance for what happened in the previous part that was the driving force of this film. But it's all the other characters' interactions with him and their machinations, because like Jessica, she was such a what a tour de force of a character she was in this.
Outstanding.
I mean, because she went from sort of a just a side character in part one, really, to being such a manipulator, and you couldn't help but some scenes just be like, I hate you.
Yeah, she really played, she played that
doing
well.
So well,
she played that just, well.
And it was just all done so convincingly. And I think for such a bizarre sort of sci-fi setting, there's so much that people could misinterpret. It was just all executed so well. And it didn't feel that at any point, despite the fact, you know, there were fetuses talking to mothers and things like that, it all translated well. And nothing like nothing got lost in the source, as we talked about before.
Yes. You
know, everything transmuted to screen excellently. And I think that should be a highlight, because as you said, this is something that people have said so often is a concept or a story that is almost unfilmable. So just to have this executed so well and as coherently, I think should really sort of stand as such a huge testament.
I think you're 100% right. I actually, if that is a high, like we can talk about, I think we'll get onto some performances, but you're 100% right that like visually this is amazing and, you know, there's great performances, the music's great, but to be able to have conveyed a story like this, which as you will be aware, Toby, and I know Simone likes to deny she's as big as a nerd as we are, but you know, she is. June has been massively influential on the sci-fi genre. And, you know, there's some things that friends of mine who watched this, who loved it, were going, oh, that's a bit, you know, contrived at points. Like there was some, which I didn't agree with them, but they were like, oh, wait a minute. It's because this has influenced like everything. This book has influenced sci-fi to no end. You know, like even as a Star Wars fan, Toby, I'm sure you can see in the voice, the Jedi mind.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. You know,
and Paul's downfall could be very much sort of akin to Anakin's downfall.
I don't want to spoil stuff for the next book, but there is 100% stuff that is almost like, I mean, sometimes I get, it's one of the reasons why the prequels annoy me even more, not to get into Star Wars, but they took they took some really good stuff from
I did it again. I made it about Star Wars.
They took some really good stuff from Dune Messiah and just kind of like went, whoop, we've ruined that, you know. Like there's some really, really good stuff that they kind of, as you say, it's that descent into villainy. But you are right, they've taken something which is like really dense and hard to read. Like Simone, I'm sure you can jump in here, but it's not a accessible book, and this film is really accessible.
Yeah, I tried to read Dune about 3-4 years ago, got about 50 pages in, and I was like, I don't know what any of this is. I don't know what's happening. I don't know. I've got I am so far from understanding. There was just so many words and terminology being thrown at me. And I was like, I don't know who anyone is. I don't know what's happening.
Yeah.
I'm 50 pages in and I've barely like, it's a tiny amount of the book. I was like, I can't go on.
I agree. Yeah, I've not read the book either, but I've learned the story through sort of osmosis over years, because my dad was a big fan of the Frank Herbert series. And he read it, and we watched the original. The David Lynch film, and he was like, "This is not a good representation of what the story is." And he kind of told me how it all went and where we get to with, say, Big Wormy Boys. But it gets real crazy.
Yeah,
really. But
yeah, it does. It gets really.
But I think if Denis Villeneuve is going to be focusing on just doing the first two books as his trilogy. Because like Dune Part 1 and Part 2 is just the first book.
Yeah, it's just Dune.
And what is it, Dark Messiah?
No, it's Dune Messiah.
Dark Messiah.
I was about to say Dark Messiah. It's Star Wars coming in there. Dark Messiah? Dark Messiah?
Again. Yeah. But do it. But yeah,
I don't think they will go any further because the rest of the universe... Now, I've read... I know of Dune...
There's six.
So okay. It's Dune Messiah, Children of Dune, Around the Planet of the Dune. No.
Underneath the Planet of
Dune's
Dune.
All that.
Dune's all that. I can't remember what the fourth one is.
Ten Things I Hate About Dune.
It's Heretics of Dune and then something House Dune. Oh, is it? Can't remember. Chapter House Dune. And that's the last book.
That sounds like a frat house book.
Yeah. I think the first two books work well because they follow Paul and they stick with Paul. Once it goes past those two books, it is no longer about Paul. Paul becomes lost in the source, and you kind of Dune is less about, I guess, Paul and more about the themes and the philosophy, and that's when those books start to get, as you say, big wormy people appear, and it gets real trippy.
From what I've understood of the first two books, is that Dune Messiah, is very much a reactionary story, sort of written story from Frank Herbert, from people misrepresenting how Paul was actually the villain of that story.
Yes, 100%.
Particularly towards the end.
Yeah.
But people seem to take him on as the genuine hero and the savior, you know, very much the white man savior.
Which is allegory. Something I've seen a bit with people criticizing this, which I'm like, I really don't think you've understood what this film's about. Like, I feel like this film makes pretty clear that this is really bad. Like, this is not a good situation. And I really don't get where people are getting that. Because it's interesting you mentioned that. I, again, spoke to someone else about that white savior narrative discussion. And I didn't get that from this film at all. I mean, did you guys at all think like, oh, this is could be interpreted as that?
Potentially.
I mean, you could, because I can see how people get there, because you do have Paul, white man.
And the whitest name, Paul.
And you've got the Fremen, who are all black and brown people. So you could, and he's being hailed as their messiah, and they're saying, as you know, this is what the text says. So I could see. As it was written.
Lishan al-Ghib.
So I can see how people get to that conclusion 100%.
But we all get that it's bad, right? That they're saying this is not a good thing.
Oh yeah,
well,
for sure.
You don't think a holy bloodshed war is a good thing? Ooh, okay. Okay.
So before we get too much into like where we think this is going to go, I mean, this kind of is a good way to segue, because I have seen some people's, I think from our opinion, incorrect lows. What sort of were there any lows that we fought in this film? I mean, we talked about performances. I just want to say before we jump too quickly to lows, Austin Butler in this, I think, is the best in this film.
Yeah.
The
best totally?
I think he is the best in the film.
Okay. Okay.
Oh, okay. I don't agree with that.
Oh, do you not? Okay. Let's get into this.
Okay.
It's turning.
He's phenomenal.
I think he steals the show. I think he steals the show with his performance.
He does. But I mean, Simone, I kind of want to know who you go first, because I don't want to copy you potentially, because I kind of feel we may have the same.
I don't know. I think Timothée Chalamet is outstanding.
Like, are we all different?
I've got different.
Oh, this is good.
This is
good. Yeah, I think, you know,
it's the Dune debate.
Dun, 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 dun.
If you say one of those weird dudes in the arena, Toby, I'm going to be like, no. That was so shocking. There we go. Oh, no. There we go. So, who would you say?
Yeah, I think Timothée Chalamet
the sickly Victorian child.
Sickly Victorian child. He is. He looks like he's got consumption. His arc in this film.
Just to be clear, he doesn't have consumption.
But he does have cheekbones for days.
He does.
He does.
Some strong cheekbones. It,
like he looks like he's skipping meals.
Great hair. God. I'm jealous of that hair. Is that a wig or is that his actual hair, do you think?
I think that's just his hair.
I don't know, but I'd like to know. If it's a wig, tell me.
You turn up to the next podcast.
I can have the curly. Yeah, yeah. So tell me what's happened. Everything.
And you were like, the spice.
Wadib. As it was written.
As it was written. So Timothée Chalamet, tell us.
Yeah, I think, you know, he starts off he's so like, not meek, but he has a lot to learn. And he when he was shouting and the sinister portrayal of him once he has is it the water of life? Is that what they call it?
Yeah.
That switch knocked me for six. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh my God, this man is acting.
Yeah.
He is acting. And it doesn't feel forced. It doesn't, it absolutely blew me away. I thought he was outstanding.
I think he is good. I think this is probably,
I would agree. That council scene was amazing.
Oh
yeah,
my
very
God.
Good. This him is probably the best I've seen.
None of you can beat me. Like, just...
And then when
Shut
he walks up to that dude and he's like, your mum went down to the shops that day. I saw it happen.
Yeah. And we used to call the planet Dune. You see, we put it in the title and everything.
Yeah, I loved that. I said to Simona, I went,
They said it.
But no, so you, Toby's, your choice.
I mean, it's so hard because everyone brought it for this.
Yeah.
Everyone brought it for this. Like, Stellan Skarsgård as the Baron.
Oh.
Oh,
he's
God.
Ominous and villainous and just oily. Everything you want from a baddie.
So oily.
You're right. Yeah, so oily. Austin Butler was fantastic. And I thought, I'm not going to care for him because I...
That's fair, me too. Yeah.
He seems to be the man of the hour and it kind of bugs me a bit. You know, jealousy and all that. He's a handsome dude.
He's a very contrarian.
Timothée Chalamet as well, fantastic. Rebecca Ferguson was amazing.
Oh, amazing. Yes. Yeah.
But I got to say, for me, it's got to be Javier Bardem as Stilgar.
Oh, yes. That is great. I said, what's written?
Exactly. I mean, if not for the memes alone, but he was so... He played it so well. I mean, he's a great actor. You know, Anton Sugar is a testament to his abilities. But I feel like this, it gave him brevity in a role that he's not really been able to show off very often. But you can... He was so convincing with his belief. And it didn't... Like, when there was humor, it didn't come off as mockery of his belief.
No.
But more just... It was situational humor. But... You could see how someone as impassioned as him can influence a group.
Yeah.
And you can see how he was a representation of that, I wouldn't say mass hysteria, but that sort of flock mentality, particularly when it comes to ideologies and metaphysical beliefs and all those sort of things. And I thought he was just such a good representation of that. And I think he just did it so convincingly.
Yeah,
with so much charm, and there were so many good scenes where, like, particularly in the water scene. The temple where the waters of life was all stored, and they were preserving, and they'd shown how they absorbed the dead body of all of its water and returned it to the water sort of reserve that they'd had, which one day was supposed to be re-greening the entirety of Arrakis. Yeah. And that was awesome. But just the little bit between him and Rebecca Ferguson, where she was crying because of the awe of that situation, it just represented how many bodies had been lost. And just the spectacle of that was just too much for her to bear. And he just wiped away her tear and sort of licked it away. It's like, don't waste your water. And it kind of represented the entirety of the Fremen belief.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, yeah.
It's just a subtle scene.
Yeah.
And for me, that's not that particular scene alone. It just Javier Bardem, whenever he was on, you could tell that he was having a good time. And it just added that extra layer to the film that made everything, say, with Timothée Chalamet and everyone else's sort of character arcs just that much more convincing.
That is really good argument for that, because, like, he is great. He is. There are funny bits. I love when Timothée Chalamet is like, "I'm not the Messiah," and he's like, "Only the Messiah."
He's so humble. He's so humble.
That means you're the Messiah that much more.
Yeah.
Listen, Al-Ghib.
But you are right. The reason we see him have such this fanaticism, which I think Dune, the book, and this film does such a good job of displaying, because that is what a lot of the book is dealing with. Charismatic leaders, cults of personality, fanaticism. Him in that scene where he takes the tear shows, as you say, not only their belief, but how hard of a life the Fremen have. That even tears are seen as like wastage of water, because water is so sparse, but yet they will preserve this water because of its holiness. It's like, it just shows their entire psychology so well. So yeah, great. It really, he had an amazing performance. I think the reason why I pick Austin Butler as like stealing the show is that he, much like you, Toby, I wasn't really expecting much from him. I only really knew that he was in Elvis, which from people...
It's going to be bald Elvis.
Yeah. I'm going to kill you.
Although it wouldn't be the first musician who played that role.
Steve, yes.
We're looking at you.
Bloody Sting. That film is wild, I'm not going to lie. The thing is, like, I've heard mixed things about the Elvis film. Like, I've heard very mixed things. And
yeah, me too.
It may not be his fault. It may be Baz Luhrmann, because Baz Luhrmann is always, like, doing a whole bunch of spice and then making a film. But the... or at least that's how it feels. He doesn't actually do any spice, as far as I'm aware of. But I just was like, I don't know what we're really going to get here. But from the moment he's in that scene and he just butchers those two maids of his, like, viciously, from that point on, I genuinely had, like, an uncomfortable feeling every time he was on the screen that something awful was about to happen.
You got the fear.
And the fact he was able to do that, I'm like, he this performance, he achieved everything he wanted from it.
Yeah.
And that's why I felt like he stole the show. And interesting.
He was channeling a lot of Stellan Skarsgård, particularly in the voice as well, wasn't he?
Yes. Yeah, he did say, I mean, I don't know about this voice
makes sense. Thing
that he does. Yeah, it does make sense. I don't know. Apparently a skill of his as an actor is to change and manipulate his voice, but apparently he couldn't get rid of Elvis for whatever.
It's called acting fouling.
The soul of Elvis took over.
He's
his
possessed.
But he, apparently he took on Skarsgård's sort of voice for this, which totally worked. Yeah. Like, and the fact that you could totally see the Baron was like, oh, I do like this kid, but I also kind of want this kid not to be around because he's kind of threatening my position. And he improvised that bit where the Baron kissed him and then he like grabbed him and kissed him back. And I was like, that
I'd kiss Stellan Skarsgård if he was in front of me. Too, I'd still a little smooch, be like,
So yeah,
no, I'm good. Sorry, Baron. I'm good.
You're too oily for me. I don't
let me
it's all over my hands.
I'd jump into that oily bath with him.
We can heal up together.
Do you want me to turn on the bubbles?
He's like, can you get out of this? please give me space. So I guess, like, we all love performances. There are some, for me, I have got by lows. I don't want to be contrarian. I can maybe just say one of the
lows. Yes, you do.
I'll say one of my lows before we get into your lows, because it kind of links what we're talking to about performances. Now, it is not a low. It's not a low that I'm like, this affects the film. But Christopher Walken for me in this film is kind of just playing Christopher Walken. He's not doing anything else.
It's Christopher Walken in a bathrobe, isn't he?
Yeah. And is he good? Yeah, I mean, he's Christopher Walken, but it's not really like...
He's not the emperor of the universe, is he?
No.
Yeah.
And when he's going to Paul, he's like, yeah, I killed him because he was weak. I was like, this is really weird.
So he follows the rules of the heart.
Yeah, weird performance for me. Not bad, but just didn't fit. What did you guys think of Christopher Walker in his bathrobes?
I mean, I thought, I guess it's kind of the, how am I phrasing it? What are my thoughts here? Where am I going with this? No, I think it's that whole thing of like, he's saying to Paul, oh, your dad was weak, but look at him. He's a frail old man that doesn't really, like if he had to go hand to hand with someone, he couldn't really do that. And so I guess it's like, that's, I think that's what they were going for. That sort of like,
I just don't feel it worked though. He just kind of was Christopher Walken. That's the, like,
yeah. When
I thought another actor that sprung to mind, I mean, I am stealing some suggestions from a great YouTuber, which I will shout out as we go along, but she suggested, we're not going to do it now.
Let me plagiarize his work.
They said Gary Oldman or Patrick Stewart would have been two good choices for a Emperor of the Universe sort of position with some gravitas of like, because Walken has a different type of gravitas. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I think I'm 100% because I just, like, I love Christopher Walken. I just felt in this, everyone else, they became their characters. You know, everyone, I didn't see Timothy Chalamet. I saw Paul Atreides. I didn't see, I definitely didn't see Austin Butler. I saw Fade Rafa, you know, even like Batista, everyone, they became
Batista was
characters.
Great.
Yeah, as Rabbit, like everyone, Duncan Florence Idaho, Pugh. Yeah, not Duncan Idaho, yeah, Gurney,
Florence Pugh as well.
Yeah, everyone, they felt like the characters, but Christopher Walken just kind of felt like he turned up for set. He may have been wearing his own bathrobe.
Turned up in it.
Yeah, he's like, hey guys, we doing this? Okay, cool. Yeah. And it was like maybe a day's work to do those two or three scenes he was in, because that's about what he was in. And he just felt out of place in that world.
Yes.
It wasn't that Christopher Walken was bad. It's just he didn't fit in the world that they'd created, particularly as the Emperor of the universe. And I kind of get the sense of what they were trying to do there was that despite the fact he is the Emperor of the known universe, he's still got quite humble, got quite a humble appearance. You know, that's why the robe was very understated. It wasn't like some big grandiose thing. But I kind of feel like in the world that they've built, it would have made more sense to have more grandiose.
You know, in the book, it's very grandiose. Just
and that's the thing, because his daughter, she's adorned with those really cool-looking sort of
headpieces.
Yeah. They were spectacular.
Again, and the Bene Gesserit as well, the big hats.
Oh, yeah. The pops on the head.
And the costume design in this was so good because we said about how the Harkonnens really looked extreme in their appearance. Everyone else kind of, it was a perfect representation of what the people were of those particular areas. Like the veiled garments for the Bene Gesserit shows the shadowy machinations that they're working in the background. The Harkonnens, the starkness, the cruelty, everything else. And the Atreides, they were very sort of more regal and militaristic, but a sense of honor. Mm-hmm. The Fremen, people of the earth, they're more attuned with the desert. So they all represent that. But the Emperor just kind of felt like the odd one out.
Emperor, he just got out of the shower. That's the...
Exactly.
He just wrapped up.
I still feel like... is he not just like a representation of like an old man in a job that like he probably shouldn't be in anymore, just clinging to power, even though he doesn't have,
I just feel
he doesn't have it anymore. He doesn't have it. He's lost it.
I just feel like,
and he's holding on to it.
If we were picking an older actor, if I was to be like, pick an older actor, I feel like an Ian McKellen as well. Like
Ian McKellen would have been good.
Yeah. Like,
oh, Ian
McKellen would have been amazing, right? Couldn't you imagine that scene where he's telling him your dad was
old
weak?
That old English, you know, the old English villainy would have come out there. And that would have kind of felt, because it would have been an age-old sort of villainy that has kind of lost its step.
Yes.
You know, we British, we're not as... not what you used to be.
Not more. Actually, that's a good shout. That's a very good shout.
Whereas instead, it's Christopher Walken kind of sounding like a New York Hey, I killed your dad because he's weak, huh?
Do you know how I got this watch?
I'm walking this here.
This is your dad's watch.
This is your dad's watch.
Up my ass.
Did you guys have any other lows or things that you felt weren't expected?
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Landed on well or were... Or was everything just great, you know?
I mean, I think it's not a low. I could have sat and watched half an hour more.
Yeah. I mean, that's not a low.
No. I know, that's my low.
It was too short.
Yeah. It was too short. Genuinely, I feel like so much happened. We could have had more.
Yeah.
I feel like they left stuff on the cutting room floor.
They definitely did. There's actually a lot of interesting stuff that we can get to.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I think if I've got a low, it's that. It kind of stems from the wanting more, and when you've got so much good things, it feels rude to ask for more.
Please, sir, can I have some more?
Exactly, we're all on the same page with that. Yeah,
Timothy Chalamet.
Yeah. Yeah. Please, Mr. Villeneuve.
And this is like
Chalamet's here, the Victoria boy.
Please, sir, can I have some more?
Yeah, some more lines. Some more lines.
But I think if there's anything, and this is less a. It's a criticism, but it feels more of a want for the next film. This film expanded Arrakis, and it gave us a taste of what the wider universe was. But I want to see an expansion.
Yeah. I agree with this.
Because I think what these films have done a great idea of what Arrakis is, kind of a gist of Gailey Prime. And you see what, maybe two very brief scenes of Caliban. And are we saying that where the Emperor was, that's a separate planet? I'm not really sure.
But yeah, I think they didn't say.
I'd kind of like an understanding a bit more of how all these intricate houses fit into a wider universe. Because we talked about them very briefly, and we've got a gist that there are these other houses out there. The Emperor is sort of leading them all, and how commerce is led by this spice, but we don't really get a taste of that. We're just sort of told it, and that's enough within the film. But it would be nice for me, particularly in the third film, is an expansion of that, so we can see more of the wider world and how the consequences of what's happening on Arrakis, Gailey Prime and everything else has this wider effect on the universe.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I totally agree with this.
That's the small criticism, but it's less of a critique of the film, but more of just I want to know more of the world building.
Yeah, I completely agree with this, and I think it's something that building. I mentioned to Simone is that, you know, when we rewatched Dune the day before we went to see Dune Part 2. So something I felt in Dune was that they didn't expand enough on the religious fanaticism that the book really discusses and the cult of personality. This film does that. And I was like, brilliant. I was patient. Now the Lanzarad, which is that group that you're talking of, is just not mentioned in the first film until like halfway through, where Duncan's like, you got to tell the Lanzarad. And I was like, you got to tell the who? and I knew who that was, but it is a little bit like, who the hell are the Lanzarad? And like, I feel like
hopefully the third one
does do that, because I think the Lanzarad is something they need to explore. I think the big thing I do feel you've kind of touched on it there. I do think it is, even if they do it in the third one better, I still think it is a flaw in these three films. They do not show, I feel, the importance of spice enough.
Like,
it's just kind of like, oh yeah, spice, people bloody take it. Like, spice essentially is the petrol and the fuel of
this. It's their whole means of space travel.
Yeah. If they have no spice, everything falls apart.
Yeah.
Like, Mentats, which again they don't really go into, which is a shame, but I'm kind of like, okay, they've only got 2.5 hours, we can't go into everything, but you know,
Tifu was cut,
which is something Simone, you mentioned scenes being cut. Tifu, the Mentat from the first film, which is the head of the spies, the guy with the lip and the blue, he's in this film, but they cut out all of his scenes, which Villeneuve said was one of the hardest things he's ever done as a director. But he had to, just because of the time. There just wasn't enough time to put it.
There was plenty of time. I could have sat there for 3.5 hours. But suck it, Oppenheimer.
Mentats are human computers, because computers are banned in this universe. And spice lets people be computers. It lets people be spaceships. It is the fuel.
It lets people be spaceships.
I stand by what I said. You haven't read the book. Simone, you do not know. The Spacing Guild is one of the trippiest things you'll ever read / see if they choose to do it.
I'm going to read the book.
But
now,
I stand by my description. If somebody went, describe the Spacing Guild, people become spaceships. That's the way I would
describe Adeptus Mechanicus.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. Warhammer is massively influenced by this, by the way. But
oh god, here we go.
It really is. It really is.
No Warhammer.
No. Yeah. Well, I actually think a
vetoing Warhammer.
For the Emperor.
The positive of this film is that I feel like if there was a Warhammer film, people would bloody get it, because if they can do Dune, they can do Warhammer. All right. Like, but the spice. Back to my point, they just do not at all like show how important the bloody spice is. And when he's like, I'm going to blow up all the spice with my nuclear bombs, I know it was meant to be feel really important, but because they hadn't really set that up as much, it didn't feel like that to me.
Yeah, because they briefly blurb on it in the first one, but they don't really expand upon it.
Yeah,
you kind of just get the idea that it's kind of just a recreational thing.
That's what I kind of got too.
It's more like
they did not.
People really like spicing up their ham. But it's like a condiment or an actual food spice. You're right. They don't expand upon it.
People bloody love this paprika. I don't know what.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it used to work in the old days.
The paprika, not enough. They're not using it enough.
But I 100% agree. And that's part of the world building. Like, it didn't show enough of sort of the commerce and how it all... what Arrakis really meant to the universe, because they said it's the most important sort of zone, because it's the only source of spice in the known universe. Okay, what are the ramifications of that?
Yeah. Will the universe just suddenly collapse? Like, and I don't think they would have needed change much to get that in. I just think it needed to be more dialogue or like discussion, even with the Emperor, more discussion over like, you know, when the spice harvests are going wrong, and we see the Baron getting annoyed that the spice harvest is getting wrong with Raban.
Yeah.
If you had put a bit more of Christopher Walken being like, hey, where's my spice, huh? Like, where is this?
Yeah. And or just like, showing how it was used for space travel.
Yes. Well,
you know, because they did some space travel, but actually show how that works.
Yeah, I think the issue with showing that, again, you kind of know a bit, Toby, from mentioning Adeptus Mechanicus, but the spice and the Spacing Guild, and this does lead us quite nicely into our next bit about the book, they are weird. That is, like, really weird. And, like, the Spacing Guild are essentially... well, they might do it, but they're really weird. I censored myself there, because it is all kind of levels of stuff that I just... it's some of the stuff that makes Dune almost difficult to film, because, like, I don't know how that would work. If anybody's a Doctor Who fan and remember the face of Bo from Doctor Who, like, it's... Yeah, Simone's like, I'm not that big of a nerd, but, like, some listeners
never
are
watched
like,
an episode.
I know.
Yeah, it's kind of like that, but more horrific and... Yeah. Mutated and disgusting.
I think he can do it, because I mean, if he can make the worms look convincing and I mean, Arrival, his film Arrival.
Yeah, good point.
He made such a really cerebral and surreal form of Alien convincing. I feel like he's got the touch. He's got the touch. I think he could do it. Yeah, I think that he could make. He'd put his own spin on it, and I think that's basically been what he's been doing with Dune from the get go. He's taken the essence of what it is, and he's made it consumable for a mass audience, but not lost the essence of what it is. And I feel like he could do it.
So I guess with those, he could do it, and I think you're right. And I mean, the book has got deviations though because of some of the weird stuff. Now, we're not going to get into all of that because Toby, Simone, you haven't read the books. Also, we'll be here for hours otherwise, and you could 100% go to YouTube, look up people like Comic Book Girl 19, Quinn's Ideas. Both of them have very good... both of them are huge Dune fans, and both of them have done like an hour to 2 hour videos on the differences in these films. So definitely recommend that. But was there differences we felt, you know, or were there things that we saw that we really felt worked? I think one for me, which Simone, I think you mentioned quite a lot, was the Fremen's representation, that you understand in the book they were a homogenous mass who just blindly followed Paul. In this, then less so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I think in this, we've got the idea, like, Paul's the Messiah, but I feel like it's not just a comment on religion. I feel like they're talking about society, and it's about society and politics, just in general. Like, we've got these older people who are more susceptible to propaganda, and like that mirrors like with Trump, Brexit, and then you've got these younger ones who are like a bit skeptical about those in power. But I think ultimately the point that Villeneuve lands on is that anyone can be taken in by like a powerful leader. And we see that with everyone bowing to him at the end. I thought it's a very, very powerful message.
And I think it's a good change. The book's intention is this too, and Herbert spoke a lot about like dangerous leaders. He said one of the most dangerous leaders in modern history, in his opinion, was JFK, because he was so charismatic, people just wouldn't say no to him. Yeah. And I think the book has obviously Paul's inner monologue, so you can get his opinion on what's going on. So you don't need to have as much deviation in the Fremen people. Whereas in the film, because you don't have an inner monologue, you do need to have more dissenting voices to show that. And I think Chaney, being that Zendaya's character and the younger Fremen, is a great choice. Toby, yeah. I mean, is that something you picked up on too?
Yeah, well, I mean, again, one of the things I have gleaned was that Chaney's character in Dune was radically different from the film representation.
Very different. Very different.
She was more the voice of reason in this. And like you say, she and the younger characters in the sort of the encampments and things were more the voice of opposition of this religious belief and this chosen one prophecy. And you know, they're right to do so. It's all Bene Gesserit propaganda. And I really liked the sort of turning point towards the end where Simone mentioned how everyone at the end bowed to Paul, but Chani didn't. In fact, she sort of rejected the proposition, whilst in the book, I know she sort of goes along with it. And she doesn't marry Paul, but she becomes his concubine, like Rebecca Ferguson's character, Jessica, with Duke Leto in the first film. And I think one of the central conflicts to what might come up in Messiah,
Good segue.
Is potentially how that quite significant change could have ramifications in part three. Does part three have a huge change of sort of story points to sort of more have this two-way conflict mm-hmm. between the fanatics and the non-believers, with Chani is sort of the direct opposition. Because having that central conflict between your two leads, really, of this movie would really drastically change the outcomes of the subsequent Dune films or the franchise.
Yeah, big time. Yeah.
You know, because I don't want to give too many spoilers for what's to come, just, you know, for people to want to watch it. But there's a lot of potential storylines that could get cut short if these two don't come together at the end. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I use that as a euphemism in more than ways than one. but I thought that was really quite brave of Denis to sort of take that story route. Plus, it was good because she was always quite resistant from the get-go. And she was very much like, you're kind of the outsider, but she warms to him. But she still kind of keeps him at an arm's length. Because mm-hmm. there's that exchange between the two where he's like, you're never really going to trust me, are you? And she says, well, you're an outsider.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that kind of is the undercurrent from the get-go, that she doesn't really have that sort of trust for him. And she's not drinking the Kool-Aid.
No.
I thought that was a really good choice. And I don't, having not read it myself, I'm not particularly perturbed by that change. I don't know how you as a reader of the book or how more Dune hardcore fans would have found that, but I thought story-wise, I thought that was a good choice.
I think there are some Dune hardcore book readers who probably won't like this film. I think I have seen some of that online. What I say to those people is that they can shut up, because like, it's an adaptation. And I think the thing I really got and liked from this is that in the book, you have his internal monologue. You have that internal monologue where he's questioning whether this is the right or wrong thing to do. You don't have that in this film. It's really hard to do that too. And it could be misinterpreted. And by making that change to having that dissenting voice and Chani being that, I think it worked really, really, really well. And I actually think it's and look, some big fans might dislike me for saying this, but I actually think it's a good change from the book. I think having the Fremen, having different parts and different groups that think this might work and not work, and he is the Messiah, he's not the Messiah, he's a naughty boy, you know, it's a good breakdown of like that. And I think that's the right thing to have done. So there's a lot of things that they changed, and we could go into loads of them. But I think as a fan of the book and a fan of this film, firstly, what I would say to people is like, watch this film before you read the book, actually. It's something I'd say, because the book is very unforgiving. This is actually a very forgiving film to get into. I don't think it's too dense or like unapproachable, but also it kind of cuts out all of the weird things. So there's still kind of weird stuff to look forward to, which one of the weird things they cut out for the film, which I think actually works, is that, you know, this film, the book takes place over like 5 years. Yeah. And his sister is born, grows up to be a 2-year-old possessed child who is like the creepiest. Go watch the 80s film. That child is the creepiest child in the world. And it's the child who kills the Baron. And that's fine. And it kind of makes sense for the book, because more stuff will happen with that child and the Baron. And I don't want to spoil anything there and so forth. But for this film, and I think for this trilogy, I think him killing the Baron makes total sense, because it's like a fight, it's a completing his journey.
It's his journey, yeah.
Mm. Yeah. So that's something to answer your question, Toby, on as a book reader, I think I really liked it. I don't think any of the changes really annoyed me or anything I found wrong. I just wish they had talked about spice more. That's all.
Yeah. I think the other thing potentially is it kind of jumps onto this point about Alia the child, or Alia the child.
Yeah.
Is that, it's an interesting plot point, and yes, there are, because again, I've skipped ahead and I've read tidbits as to what's coming, and there's some interesting plot points with that character. I think the only downside to doing it the way this film does, i.e. the fetus not being born, is it condenses and it shortens the length of time for this fanaticism to take hold, because I guess realistically, this, like, Rebecca Ferguson isn't, oh, sorry, Jessica isn't really showing at the beginning of the movie, but she's well on her way to dropping that baby anytime now. So we're saying that the entirety of this movie sort of takes place over the course of maybe 8 to 9 months.
Yeah.
If we're generous.
Yeah. That's fair. I mean, I have seen people say pacing is an issue a bit there.
Because there, some of the continuity, I guess, this is really nitpicky, but some of the continuity in terms of like travel times and things like that, it gets a little bit, okay, well, how does that work logistically in the world of the law? Because my understanding was that space travel takes a lot of time and effort, even with spice. So characters are coming and going a little bit more casually, like generic sci-fi, opposed to the world, like the lore that they built in the story of the first film. And again, this is all supposed to be taking place within the space of 8 months or 9 months, whilst with a 5-year gap of a film in the story of the book, that gives you a lot more leeway with some of these timings.
I agree. And I actually think it's not nitpicky, actually. I think there is a real concern for the third film, which we can talk about what we want in that third film. But something I think is of genuine time concern is that they have cast Anya Taylor-Joy in the role of his sister.
Yes.
And she's in this film. She sees him as a forward premonition.
Yeah.
Now, they might just be like, she was one and done, which is kind of weird for such a high profile actor to be one and done. Now, there is a 12-year jump between Dune and Dune Messiah.
Yeah.
I think it's likely that Villeneuve will not make his next film, will not be Dune Part 3. I think there will be a gap.
Good five years.
Yeah, but then the question is, within the universe, how big of a gap has there been for Anya Taylor-Joy to look the way she does, but then Paul to not have aged significantly as well?
Well, I guess this is where you can jump in with the spice side of things, because spice, doesn't that also help preserve like longevity
it does.
Of life?
There you go.
It does, but what I would say,
they haven't excused that enough.
Yeah, I was about to say, then why have we got Christopher Walken? Because like,
I guess hundreds of thousands book, of years, opposed to thousands
that guy,
of years.
That guy in the book is a real old man. Hundreds of years old man, and he's looks like in his 30s, and I actually don't mind them having an old emperor. I think it's fine. I'm totally cool with that. But then you kind of have to say that spice doesn't make you really young, because then everybody would be having the bloody spice like they do in the book.
Well, they say they could say it's less about making them look young, but more about prolonging and preserving life, so it extends it. So, you know, Christopher Walken looks like an old man, but he's technically hundreds of years old.
Yeah.
I mean, you'd have to say thousands, I think.
Well, you could do. Because I guess the span of 12 years, because maybe they could also say, and I'm really just making up things for them. Denis, give me a call. You could say that they only give the spice at a certain age.
Yeah.
Because they have to get them to, say, maybe past puberty, which is why Paul wouldn't have taken it yet, but whilst he's now on Arrakis, he's exposed to it. Therefore, it's preserving his longevity and his life cycle. And then Anya Taylor-Joy, she sort of matches his age by the time, you know, she's able to start taking it. Because isn't Paul supposed to be sort of a young teen to early 20s?
Yes.
Like much akin to what he's actually ages in this?
Yeah. And that... It could work, but I think
I'm making stuff up for them. But
you know, you're doing a good job.
You started the writer's room.
You're doing a good job. All I would say is, I don't want to be critical of a film that's not come out yet, but if they do that, I'm kind of like, well, you didn't explain that in any of the other films. You've kind of just used this as a way of kind of writing yourself out of a hole that you cast Anya Taylor-Joy to be his younger sister, and they're kind of the same age.
Yeah, I mean, but then this could have been stuff they cut on the floor.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I'm hopeful that Villeneuve has thought forward. You know, he's an outstanding director. I'm sure he has an idea for where she's going to slot in, or maybe she doesn't slot in.
I mean, if he is one and done, that will be wild. That would actually be really wild. If they,
I mean,
like,
but who wouldn't want to be in
this
film?
She's there for a 30-second scene and then gone. Yeah.
Unless they have a little kid, and then most of the communications that come... Because, like, her character comes more prevalent in later books, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I was about to say...
You could just have it that she's a little girl throughout the film, and then all of the Anna Taylor-Joy scenes are flash-forwards, much like it was in this.
I was about to say...
Future communing.
You could do that. Because I think the end of part three is going to be where June Messiah ends. I think the ending of that book and the ending of this film will be the end. And that will be the end of the June saga in cinema, because it is kind of a nice finality. How we get there, I think, will be significantly different. And I think it will have things that are very similar, but I think that sister will be one that has to be completely different. Maybe as a child, you have the flash forwards, kind of makes sense. But I think that is going to be significantly different, because otherwise I'm like, why did you cast Anna Taylor-Joy? Like,
how long is Dune Messiah? Is it the same size
as
Dune?
No, it's thinner.
When we say thinner, is it just
it's the size of it's the size of a normal book. That's what I would say. It's the size of a normal... Dune is the size of a dictionary, whereas like June Messiah is probably like your normal
history
size. Yeah, your horror. Yeah, no, bigger than that.
Your goosebumps.
It's your goosebumps. Like June is Lord of the Rings. June Messiah is Hobbit, I guess. That's probably a good...
Azkaban versus Philosopher's Stone.
Yeah. So or June Messiah...
Goblet of Fire, that's the biggest one, isn't it?
Yeah. It's huge, that one.
Goblet of Fire is huge, yeah.
Yeah, so I think Dune Messiah is easier to probably put into one film. I think you definitely could do that. You're just going to drop a lot of stuff, which, I mean, they've dropped stuff from here, as we mentioned. But what I guess is, Toby, you know a bit of what's going to come. Simone is somebody who's not. Is there anything you would like to expand on, I guess? You've mentioned the Lanzarad and the houses. Simone, is there anything you would want? And I've mentioned spice. I want spice.
I mean, I've not read the book, and I don't really know much of the Dune story, so I don't have anything that I know for sure is in the book in greater detail that I want them to bring out. I suppose what I'm hoping for in the third film is I want Paul's character to come back round, but I'm not sure I'm going
to
get that.
Oh, you want him to be a good guy again? Oh.
I want him to come back. I don't think that's going to happen. I think it's a commentary on ultimate power corrupting absolutely, and full steam ahead, I guess. Full steam ahead with that. How
into
dark
the
can
Holy
we
Wars.
Go?
Yeah.
How dark can it get? Let's go.
Yeah. I mean, I want to see the conflict. Like, I think...
Oh, you want to see the actual Holy War?
Yeah, I think that... Because that is almost your gateway into the wider universe, to see how, like, what this is really... What toll this is going to wreak on the universe.
You want to see the opposite of Simone. Yeah. Simone wants to see a redemption arc. You want to see just pure
this
descent.
Because it's such a cold line that Paul uses at the end. It's like, bring them to paradise.
Yeah.
Or send them to paradise. You know, that's not like, hey, let's bring them round and give them some Kool-Aid so they can all get on board. It's, no, let's kill them all. So the non-believers, everyone that's not on board with us, they're out of the picture, you know. That's not a good guy sentiment. That is I'm in this role, this is how I've perceived as the way forward, you know. He even says this is the thin narrow path. And yes, you know, he believes it is the right path, but
interesting,
what is that right path? What is that wider meaning to everybody else in the universe?
Yeah.
Like, what does that mean for the Fremen as well? Like, if there is a jump,
no
is
one
he going to be able
clean.
To? Is he going to be able to hold on to? The like, power. Yeah.
It's
yeah.
also the right path for him.
Yeah,
that's the thing. He can see all these futures, but it's the future that I guess he's good in. Yeah. Like, might not be, as you say, it's maybe not the best for the Fremen, probably not the best for the Lanzerat, but it's the best for Paul, you know. It's an interesting change because, like, in the book, it ends with Paul kind of like, he's got his vengeance, he's got his revenge, but he's realized he's lost control. And the holy war that the Fremen are going to go on, he can't stop anymore. Whereas in this one, as you say, Toby, his last words are, send them to paradise. It's like he's choosing to destroy them.
Yeah. He's sort of given them permission to wreak terrible bloody vengeance on the universe.
Mm.
And they like the ending of that when they're all just running to the ships.
It looks like he's having a great time.
Yeah. And it just shows like just how these fanatics can just become such extremists. Mm. And you know, it's such a poignant allegory to today.
Did think that watching it, I was like, there are things in this film. Follow. Yeah, there are films and there's things in these films that I feel are very poignant to today. I think will be hard watching as well. In today's climate, there's a lot, you know, of pretty awful things that happen from a big, powerful force to a small, you know, not
small community.
Community that gets completely decimated, which was actually very difficult to watch.
That was a brutal scene. Yeah.
That was really, really tough to watch. But I feel like it's handled very well.
Yes.
And, you know, the tone of, you know, absolute power can corrupt absolutely, and cult of personality, religious fanaticism that you guys have mentioned is handled really well. So I'm glad we've all loved it and what we want to see for part three. Just in our rounding off, I guess, what do we feel towards these two films together in their totality at the moment? Because they are just two rather than three at the moment.
Yeah.
Either jump in, fight each other. Let's go into that parking and pit. Simone, you first.
I mean, yeah. I guess it could end here. It could end here. Yeah. That would be a nice way to round it up. It all goes horribly wrong. You know, you try to mess with the world, and you know what do you get? You get a holy war, and as Paul has foreseen, people
that makes it
starving.
Sound like if I go out in the street and like, I don't know, spit on the floor. Holy war, Ian, you've messed up. I've
just seen a cold It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia segment now. It's just like, I'm gonna go save the world. Caption: Paul starts a holy war.
So yeah, I think they complement each other very well. Like,
yeah,
I mean, we've spoken about this. The things in the first film that we wanted more of was explored quite fully. Mm-hmm. In this film, it's a nice two-parter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Good. And Toby?
I'd agree. It's a great two-parter. I would, however, say that my biggest point of contention in the first one was the first one was going to live or die based on if it got a second one.
Yes.
Because the ending of that was just too abrupt. And that was my biggest complaint. Mm. And if we'd never gotten a part two, I think whilst it was visually stunning and had some great storylines and things like that, I think just the ending and just the way it capped off, it was just too abrupt. And it felt like an incomplete film. Whilst I feel that part two is a phenomenal companion piece, and really it should be watched one and two. However, I think there's enough to be able to glean from the beginning and the world that they set up in two that arguably you could watch the second one as a complete film and get enough information from the story that they tell you in the film to be able to say that's a complete story. So I wouldn't say it's 100% beholden to watching the first one. But, I mean, if you're going to start watching part two, why the hell haven't you watched part one?
Yeah, why? But, why are you doing that?
But my argument is that I feel like part two is a complete film, whilst I feel like part one was very much that. It was a part one.
Mm. I agree. I, in fact, one of my, when we finished watching part one before we went to see part two, is that when Zendaya turns and goes, "It's only the beginning," I was I hate that. I actually really hated that. That didn't need to be in there. I was like, oh, that really, I just felt like it was such a wink to the camera. I just don't know. I didn't like it. I did not like that. But for the exact reasons you're listing there, it's just, But yeah, no, I think you're right. I think you're both right. I think the two companions together, I think they do kind of have to be watched. It's kind of like, what, together they're about 5 hours. I guess it's kind of like Das Boot in that way. That like
it's like
that
one of Zack Snyder's films.
We love you, Zach. Not your films, but you as a person.
Yeah.
But the
did you hear he's getting a 6-hour Rebel Moon cut for like part one or whatever, or part one and two together.
Why?
Like
why?
Netflix That's... gives him unlimited just time and resources, and Denis Villeneuve has he has to cut his movie. Give him 6 hours, and that'll
give him six hours. Like imagine like, and you think of this like Oh, we'll get back to that.
I picked like, a scab. I'm sorry.
Yeah, Das Boot was like a German film, which was like in segments, and then you can watch it all together in 5 hours. They should just do that with this. You can release that. You can now buy Das Boot as just the 5-hour film. I would just sit and watch this film for 5 hours. I'd be fine with doing that.
I said that. I would fully watch this as like a 12-part
just Dune
TV,
just like just Dune.
But you have it's shown in cinemas and it's like hour cuts. Like I
just
give
like,
it to me.
Back in the day, I've always said
12 hours of this.
I'm an advocate for longer films, but just
when
you had Dr. Zhivago, they had like an intermission where you went back and went to the toilet, got some popcorn. I'd be fine with doing that. Like, do a 4-hour film. I'm cool with 4 or 5
Weakness.
Hours.
Weakness. You got to hold that water, Ian. You've missed the message. You got to hold your water.
Precious water. But
precious water.
It's interesting, Zack Snyder, like, Rebel Moon is probably my... But as a big sci-fi fan, that is an example...
That's the antithesis of this film, isn't it, really?
Yeah, like, that film is, like, the example of how bad sci-fi can be when you've taken the elements of things that they steal stuff from Dune. They steal stuff from Warhammer. They steal stuff from Star Wars. And it's crap. It's just so bad. Whereas this, it's like, just give me more. Give me more of this.
Yeah.
What do we think, I guess, that talking of give Villeneuve 6 hours, Villeneuve as a director, like in terms of his record, we do have his French language films, which I haven't seen, I'll be honest. And I have heard they're very good. But of his last 11 years, he has made 7 films, which are, give me 2 seconds, seamless this is. I had it prepared earlier.
This is my comprehensive of IMDb. IMDb.
His 6 films, Prisoners, Enemy, Sicario, Arrival, Blade Runner 2049, Dune, and then Dune Part 2. That's his 7 films in 11 years. What do we think of? Yeah, 7 films in 11 years. How many? What do we feel of Villeneuve as a director right now?
Killing it.
Yeah, he's 7 for 7. I mean, Prisoners was
amazing,
phenomenal. That came out of nowhere for me. I watched that film and I was like, where did this film come from? This is phenomenal. It really showcased everyone involved that all of those characters could act. Like Hugh Jackman was killing it. Paul Dano was a creepy guy. It was kind of like his audition tape for the Riddler.
Mm-hmm.
And Jake Gyllenhaal got so much to consume on that. He was fantastic as Detective Loki. I loved that. And then Enemy was fantastic as well.
Amazing. Not talked about enough. No.
I've not seen Enemy.
Oh, it's so good. It's so good.
It's so creepy. It's so creepy. Oh,
you won't like it though, Simone. It's got spiders in it.
Oh, yeah, get it in the bin.
But it's a fantastic film.
And so good.
Arrival is a phenomenal sci-fi set piece. And Blade Runner 2049, I arguably feel that I prefer it to the original.
Get out! Get out!
I know! I know!
Get out!
Oh my
get
god!
Oh, I know! No!
How dare you?
Sacrilege!
Well, come back, listeners, for we have a show on our episode called on our own channel. If you go to Spotify, the Phantom Zone, look us up. We have our own channel.
Or anywhere you get your podcasts.
Or anywhere you get podcasts. Nice and subtle. Go listen to us, please. We have something called Movie.
Please,
the Phantom Zone debates, and for sure we're going to do the original Blade Runner versus Blade Runner 2049. That's outrageous. My anger knows no bounds.
Here we go.
I like that film, but how dare you say that?
I'm in the hot seat.
Are you ready to rumble?
No, Sim.
Buy it. I'll debate that.
Sim, moving away from Toby's madness. What do you know?
Outrage. Outrage.
What do you think of Villeneuve as a character?
I mean, he's as I said, he's killing it. Like, I haven't seen Enemy, but Prisoners, Sicario, Arrival, 2049, two parts of Dune, like every film there is outstanding. Every film there is amazing. I think out of all of them, I like Arrival the most. That's my fave.
Fair.
Oh no, sorry. No. It's Dune Part 2. What am I doing? What am I doing?
I don't know. It's tough. Which one I think's the best.
But before Dune, it was Arrival. But yeah, he's a phenomenal director. He is outstanding in his field. Like, yes. He is standing out there. He's out there in the field.
He just shows if you give people with skill faith and just no interruptions, that they can produce something fantastic.
Yeah.
He just hasn't had the credit. And I mean, if anything, the box office to really represent that.
Yeah. I mean, it's tricky because this one is 190 million. We always say put another 100 million on that for marketing. Mm-hmm. And I mean, those popcorn buckets aren't going to be paying for themselves. So
yeah, but that was free. But that was marketing
gold.
I mean, that was going through the socials all over the place.
It was, but they have just box office has just gone over 190 with 198 million. So it's just made back its initial budget. It hasn't made profit arguably yet. So I guess we'll have to wait and see. I think I agree with you. I think he's an amazing director. I think he's probably my favorite director right now. I think he is, you know, making things that other directors like Christopher Nolan wish they could make. And I think he is just like truly an auteur. And something he's mentioned, which got me very excited, is that Toby, I'm not sure if you've seen this, he would like to make a Batman Beyond.
Yeah.
Which I'm like, yes.
Boy.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. If there is a film in between Dune Part 2 and Dune Messiah, do Batman Beyond in the Blade Runner 2049 style.
Yes, the best and,
Please, please.
Yeah, right. This would be the good sort of segue before you do Dune Part 3.
Yeah, and
Harry McGinnis just old Bruce Wayne.
You heard it here first. And get Michael Keaton in. Get him actually in. That would be so good. And not in the weird, crappy Flash film. Get actually Michael Keaton in to be actually... That would be good. Anyway. And have Timothy Chalamet. Bring them all back. Bring everybody. So it was written, we must end the show. And it's been a pleasure having you both here. It's been great. I've loved it. I hope you guys have too. It's been a pleasure. And we'll be back again soon. I want to thank the listeners for listening. You can find us, as I mentioned, on all podcast platforms. Just look us up. It's the Phantom Zone. Go listen to us. We talk all kinds of nerdy things, comic books, video games. We talked Madam Web recently. That was an experience. Not like this one, though, I'll tell you
certainly
that.
Talked
But then you can also find UK Film Review. They have a myriad of other shows that you can listen to, like Gay Actually and The Screen Test. Totally recommend them. They also have their film club, which is great as well. But it's been a pleasure. and come back any time to the magical sands of Arrakis. Thank you, listeners, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.